On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com.
Warm welcome to all our listeners today. This is Professor David Block, and the program is entitled Looking Up with David Block. I would suppose that today it would be more beneficial for us to be looking down instead of looking up, because certainly at our home in Northcliffe area, we have no water. So everybody seems to be looking down today, desperately trying to find that last wee drop of water. And I suppose that if I were looking up at this stage instead of looking down, trying to find water for our twin boys and for Aaron, I might suffer the fate of Marie Antoinette. And so, indeed, while I'm looking up today, I've also been looking down, trusting that the maintenance crews will get the rivers to flow, the dams to flow, so that tonight when I get home, we indeed have rivers of living water. It often does pay off to be an expert looking up, but also in looking down as well. And today, in fact, that's exactly what we're going to do. But before I introduce my very special studio guest, you can reach us in studio at 0861 555 189. That's 0861 555 189. The Twitter handle is at CliffCentral.com, at Instagram Cliff Central, Facebook Cliff Central, and the ID on WeChat is also Cliff Central. You're listening to Professor David Block. And my studio guest today is someone who I have the utmost and greatest respect for. He's a professor, not only a professor at the university in which at which I work, Wits University, but Michael has worn many, many hats over the years. Professor Michael Sears. Professor Sears has occupied many very interesting positions over the years. I well remember the years 1988 to 1990 when Professor Sears was Dean of the Faculty of Science at Wits University, and he was kind enough, most gracious, to actually invite me to serve as Assistant Dean during those 2 years. Michael left Wits for a little while, became manager of the remote sensing unit at Anglo-American Corporation. And as I say, he's worn a number, variety of different hats over the years in terms of mathematics, the Mathematical Sciences Committee, and so on. But today, listeners at cliffcentral.com, we're going to be concentrating on something which is exceedingly interesting, and that is Professor Sears' area of expertise, which is remote sensing. Now, in a sense, just before I ask Professor Sears to explain exactly what remote sensing is, one must understand that what he is about to say will really link the macrocosm, that which I study, the universe and satellites and so forth, to the microcosm, what happens in your home, what happens in your environs, and so forth. So, Michael, it's the greatest of joys to welcome you to Cliff Central Studios today. And I'd like to kick off with a question. What exactly is remote sensing?
David, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, and good afternoon to all your listeners at Cliff Central on your program, Looking Up. And in answering your question, I also will link with looking down, because most people at least think of remote sensing as something you do from way above the earth, from a satellite or perhaps from an aeroplane, and that's pretty well correct. That is the general form of remote sensing. Mm-hmm. But when I think about your question, it's actually a very good one, because there's not a very well-drawn line between what is remote sensing and what it is not. So let's start off with your satellites. We have satellites going around the Earth, as we all know, and they're doing all sorts of different things. And some of them are supplying feeds for GPS coordinates for us so that we don't get lost in the traffic in Johannesburg and elsewhere. And others are providing basically conduits for programs like this and internet connections all around the world. And others are looking down. Others have got different sorts of cameras, different sorts of sensors on them, which look down at the Earth and then feed back information to us that we can use to try and help us manage what we do and what we see on this planet that we're all so fortunate to have. So that's the very furthest form of remote sensing. But also, a lot of remote sensing activities take place from aeroplanes. It may be something like taking pictures of a suburb, aerial photography, so that one can make a new map or something of that nature. That's remote sensing. And then still other remote sensing will take place right at the ground itself, where we are using a sensor to perhaps measure different properties of a leaf, or looking down into the ground. We have some system on the ground surface which is trying to tell us what's going on deep in the center of the Earth. And you had a program recently on earthquakes and the structure of the Earth. So that is also, to my way of thinking, remote sensing. Now, sometimes you'll find people will say, oh, no, that's not remote sensing, that's geophysics. But these are the sort of discussions and arguments which I don't think are very interesting. It's a matter of what you call something rather than the interesting things that you're able to do.
What's, of course, very interesting about remote sensing is, as you say, in a sense, of course it's remote, but where does one actually, set the limits? I mean, if we think of, for example, my domain of astronomy, using cameras on board satellites and spacecraft, we're able to look back billions of years into time. But what I really am so fascinated by, Michael, is the fact that in your area of remote sensing, you really are, in a sense, enriching our lives and our futures, as you've discussed already, the GPS, the aeroplanes, the aerial photography. And, of course, what's so interesting is you at the University of the Witwatersrand and formerly at Anglo-American, we're really at the cutting edge of all of this. How would you say that South Africa ranks in general in remote sensing compared to, say, Harvard or Princeton?
Well, I guess if you take universities like that, you're talking about the academic aspects of remote sensing. And it is an academic subject. And again, it fits into all sorts of different categories because some of it is very mathematical. And I'm in computer science, you're in applied maths. We're both, I think, remote sensors. It's in geography, it's in biology. There are just a huge variety of departments where people work with it. And in a sense, it's more a tool for many people than something that they study. But I think, let me answer your question slightly differently. I think South Africa has got some world experts in remote sensing. We've got the Satellite Application Center, which has some very, very strong research activities, as well as being a very important conduit again for this data that's coming from all this information that's coming from space to us. And when I was at Anglo-American, we actually built the first commercial hyperspectral sensor. Well, it was actually built in Australia, but we managed it and we wrote all the software which enabled us to actually get information from all the data. So I think that South Africa, and I just mentioned that because I was involved in it, but many, many other people around South Africa who are very much involved in this. And of course, you've mentioned the astronomy aspects. And we've got the huge new radio.
The SKA,
the square kilometer array, which I think puts us in a leading position in that area.
Michael, do you believe that in South Africa we have got the computer facilities and capabilities to store the sort of data that one needs to store to actually be at the cutting edge? Because we were interviewing Bruce Elmergreen in one of my earlier broadcasts, who was at IBM in New York, and he was just speaking about the extreme challenges of just capturing all the data from these SKA dishes, just the data to be accumulated in 1 minute. He was talking about gigaflops and teraflops and more. Do you believe that in South Africa we have the computer infrastructure, or is this something still to be developed to handle the vast amounts of data to enable you to see the sort of images you are talking about?
Yes, again, a very good question, David. I think that in a way you put your finger on it there at the end. It's not really an issue of storing the data. Mm. It's a lot of data, but big data is now a big topic and a big issue. We've got the Center for High Performance Computing in Cape Town with leading fast mm-hmm. computing machinery and huge storage capabilities and so on. So I don't think that the issue is with the computers themselves when it comes to storage. I think the issue is in getting the information out of the data. And in my own area of hyperspectral imaging, which is not the same sort of order of data that you're talking about, but you could still get gigabytes of data in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, how do you then take this huge amount of data and get something helpful, mm-hmm. useful, meaningful mm-hmm. out of mm-hmm. it? And that, I think, is the big challenge. And mm-hmm. that's where the humans come in.
Mm-hmm.
The computers can do it fast, they can store masses of stuff, but the humans have got to decide how it is that we're going to get information out of that data.
You know, Michael, it was very interesting. This morning I was participating in an interview, and they were saying to me, David, the field that you are so passionate about, astronomy, is so esoteric in the sense that you're dealing with galaxies billions of light years away. It's nothing to do with homegrown territory. And so I gave them my answers and my thoughts in terms of the search for our roots, not only as human beings, but in terms of the cosmos and cosmology. But of course, I just like to think, for example, of someone listening to this feed, maybe in Kenya, and they, for example, are involved in growing crops. So here we have someone on Gareth Cliff listening to the stream this afternoon on Looking Up, and they, for example, growing their crops, and they want to know, are you able, as a remote sensor, to help them, an expert in remote sensing, to help them monitor, for example, the growth of their crops?
Yes, the answer is definitely yes. The thing we have to think about is what sort of scale are we looking at? What sort of level are we looking at when we do this? In Europe, for example, every year they do detailed assessments of what the different main food crops are going to produce during the season based mm-hmm. on the state of the plants at a certain time. And this is all done with satellite data. And they can actually tell, even from satellite images, what the type of the plant is and what sort of health it has. Plants have very particular characteristics, spectral characteristics. And one can tell from those spectral characteristics to some extent what they are, but certainly what sort of health they're having.
Mm.
So if one's talking at a broad scale like that, you can work from a distance scale.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking from the scale of somebody who's got their own little field and they're growing crops, well, one can help in the sense that I mentioned before. You can have spectral devices or devices of different types which would enable them to make some statements about, let's say, if there's something going wrong with the crop. But it's probably not the most efficient way of doing it. If I had a problem with a crop in a situation like that, I would call a botanist, the right sort of botanical specialist. and the botanist would come along and give me some information. Mm. And that would probably involve chemical tests and things of that nature. I could give you some other types of applications of remote sensing which might be of interest to your listeners. Perhaps some that are not quite as familiar to us as others. For example, there's a huge underground coal fire with a front ranging for tens to hundreds of kilometers in China. One can see this from remote sensing devices which can measure the heat, the thermal energy being generated by this. It's almost impossible to see it in any other way. If you flew over it with a plane, you might see some smoke here or there, but you wouldn't be able to see that sort of scale. Some of this information can help us to control something like that, because you can imagine the amount of pollution that's being caused by something like that, out of control, in a stage of our planet's career where we're trying to control greenhouse gases and trying to control climate change, which we can also measure from satellites, which measure different types of gases in the atmosphere. So there are lots of different applications, quite far away from perhaps some of the ones that one might think of at first sight.
You are listening to Professor Michael Sears. This is Professor David Block, and the program is entitled Looking Up with David Block. We have a caller on the line. Heartiest welcome to Nick DeVette.
Hello, Professor.
Hi, Nick. Are you well?
I'm good, thank you.
Fine, thank you. Let us have your question. Like to, fire it.
It's not a question. I just like to say I love this show and do it every day.
Well, that's just great news. And I trust that we are meeting your needs in terms of varied topics of interest. But if there's any specific topic, Nick, that you'd like me to address, just reach me on my Facebook page. Sorry, on my web page, which is www.davidblock.co.za. Just hit the contact button or just send a message to me via Twitter. My handle is @StarryGalaxyMan. But thank you so much for that encouragement.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. And so, Michael, we've been talking about fires in China. That's quite extraordinary because the current fire raging there is thousands of kilometers in extent, is it not?
Yes, that's correct. It's really is out of control at this point. And people don't realize that coal can burn underground, and it's not that somebody set the fire, it's spontaneous. And it's a huge problem. Unfortunately, the remote sensing isn't helping us fix the problem, but at least it's showing us where the problem is and perhaps giving us some ideas of where we might be able to address it in the future.
Of course, one of the areas, Michael, which has always fascinated me, I remember when you left the university to go to Anglo-American and head up the remote sensing unit, was this of mineral exploration. Because, of course, in days gone by, thinking about a drive a little while ago, my family and I undertook to Pilgrim's Rest. You know, if you wanted to find gold, the only way was you went and you started panning for gold, and you'd either find gold or you wouldn't find gold, and you'd physically have to explore on your feet. It was a very hands-on experience. And, of course, all this is really totally changed. I remember when the Oppenheimers used to have to visit mines. Again, it was absolutely hands-on. Could you tell us, could you lead us gently down the road? Could you lead our listeners gently down the road, please, of, you know, exploring for minerals using satellites and remote sensors?
Yes, well, that's a very interesting question. And, of course, this is what I was involved with when I worked for Anglo-American. And There are different scales that you can look at this. Just actually having images of the Earth with some different information from different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum enables you to make some distinctions about the different types of rocks, the different classifications of rocks. But I mentioned earlier the hyperspectral sensor.
Could you elaborate on that for our listeners?
I'll do that with pleasure. Essentially, what a hyperspectral image is it's a photograph which you take at a lot of different wavelengths. So when you take your ordinary picture with your cell phone, you're taking basically three wavelengths, one for red, one for green, and one for blue. And these three separate pictures are mixed up and turn into one single color image. But they really are three different images. Now, if you just extrapolate that a bit, what is to stop us taking a picture not in the visible region of the spectrum, but perhaps in the what we call the near infrared, which is a little bit further down the spectrum than we can see.
So the eyes are not sensitive, therefore, to
that. Our eyes are not sensitive to that wavelength, but we can build cameras that are sensitive to that wavelength. So let's say we've now got a red picture, a green picture, a blue picture, and then an infrared picture. And we can move further from that and go into the shortwave infrared and even the thermal infrared, all the time taking pictures. And if we take pictures just at very small separations in terms of their spectral regions, we end up with a stack. You could think of it like your photographs. Well, nowadays, of course, people don't have photographs that they stack, but try and visualize a whole stack of photographs, one on top of the other.
Yes.
And each photograph is at a different, taken at a different light wavelength.
Yes.
Now, it turns out that different minerals reflect differently, and plants reflect differently. Everything reflects differently in different wavelengths. So if you have a stack of information like that and you look at one point on the ground, you can see what its spectrum looks like, the curve of the different reflections in the different wavelengths.
Excellent, yes.
And that spectrum actually can tell you a lot about what that material on the ground actually is. And it's going from that stack of images to the information about what you see on the ground that's the interesting stuff with this type of technology. And that's what these sensors did. The Anglo sensor was able to see, if that's what the word you'd like to use, looking down, it could see kimberlites, which is the mineral which hosts diamonds, actually those that were exposed on the surface of the earth, it could discover those. It could also find what are called alterations, which is where the earth, the rocks of the earth have been changed due to pressure and different geological events in the past. It can't point down and say, oh, look, there's gold. That's asking too much. But it can say, oh, look, there are positions which could possibly be interesting to investigate. And this replaces, or I should not say replaces, this assists geologists going out into the field, and they can then look at the more interesting regions right away instead of having to cover the whole region on foot. So that's the sort of application where you can use these types of systems for minerals. And just adding to that very quickly, of course, sometimes what you want to do is monitor pollution. You want to see if from around a mine there actually is a spill-off of some potentially harmful material, which again you may not be able to see with the naked eye in the water courses.
Yes.
But you can see it by looking again at the spectrum from your big stack of photographs at different wavelengths.
I think there's a wonderful marriage, Michael, between your field and mine in terms of you are talking about kimberlites and alterations and so forth, and here I am studying galaxies, but it all forms under this huge hat of hyperspectral analysis, and I think it's just awesome that you can actually study the universe billions of light years away, or look at kimberlites, and nevertheless, travel and traverse down the same road. A little while ago, in fact, in June of last year, Michael, I was invited to speak in China. And in Beijing, I could hardly see for a few hundred meters down the road because of the extreme pollution. And that leads me on to the following question. Given all the incredible amount of pollution going up there, together with hosts of other different factors, is this very contentious issue of global warming, which we see happening on really global and very vast and sometimes alarming scales. Could you perhaps gently again, in your own inimitable way, lead us down that road of how remote sensing can be used to study the enigmatic global warming phenomenon?
Yes, in a way, it's only remote sensing that enables you to do that. I'm sure there'll be listeners who will be upset with me saying that. But really, once you're looking at things at the planetary scale, at the global scale, how can you make statements about what's happening in Johannesburg or what's happening in London or what's happening in even in Beijing? Mm-hmm. You have to be talking about what's happening to the atmosphere of the whole planet.
Yes.
And to do sampling for that is really very hard. So there are many satellites sensors on them, where the main reason for their existence is to try and measure as accurately as possible the different trace gases in the atmosphere. So they're looking down as well, because they're outside our atmosphere. They're looking down, but they're not looking down to the surface of our planet.
Mm-mm.
They're looking down through the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking this multiple stack of pictures and doing a lot of analysis and processing afterwards, they are able to map over time how the gas content of the atmosphere is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens at a huge scale. When we're looking at our Google Maps, which we may chat about later, we want to see as much detail as possible, as smaller detail as possible.
Mm.
When you're looking at the atmosphere, you want to look at huge chunks of it so that you can find the smallest traces of gas in it.
Mm.
And that's what these sensors are able to do.
You are listening to Professor Michael Sears, who is an expert on remote sensing. And he is our guest in the studios here in Rivonia today. You're listening to Professor David Block on Looking Up with David Block. You are most welcome to reach us on 0861-555-189. The Twitter handle is @CliffCentral.com, Instagram Cliff Central, Facebook Cliff Central, and Cliff Central is again the WeChat ID. We're going to take a little musical break now, and we're going to listen to the enigmatic Enya doing one of her magical, masterful orchestral works.
The sky would start.
You are listening to Professor David Block. Warmest welcome to the show on cliffcentral.com. My special guest in the studio in Rivonia this afternoon is Professor Michael Sears. Now, if I were to speak to the global listenership and introduce you to some titles of books like Deadly Harvest, Death of the Mantis, The Second Death of Goodluck Tinubu, and so forth, you might be wondering, well, what has this got to do with the subject of remote sensing? And the answer is nothing. But there's a very interesting link here, in that my studio guest is not only a professor of applied mathematics and computational and applied mathematics, and an expert in remote sensing, but Professor Michael Sears has done something which I regard as absolutely fascinating, and that he is an author of these books, such as Deadly Harvest and Death of the Mantis, published by HarperCollins in New York, and so forth. And I just find this all totally fascinating, Michael, that here you are, you know, you're wearing so many different hats at the university anyway, and now you're wearing all these different hats again in terms of all these books. Now, before we get into the subject of all these books on fiction, you know, there might be vast myriads of numbers of people out there who are listening to us today and who are saying to themselves, well, look, I really would, my dream is to become a writer, but what do I actually do to become a writer, given the immense amount of competition? How did you actually personally enter this highly competitive field?
Well, thanks for the question, David. And yes, your listeners may be surprised that I'm a co-writer, actually. I write the books with somebody else. We write together under the name Michael Stanley. So, if they look for books, mysteries with the name Michael Sears, they'll actually find some, but there's another Michael Sears who writes mysteries. So if they want to, if they would like to see mine, it's under the name of Michael Stanley, and I write the books with Stanley Trollope. So a very good question is, well, how did I come to start writing mysteries, fiction, when and with somebody else at that, when my background is in the mathematical sciences and my research interests, we've been chatting about a bit early in the program. It really all goes back a very long way. Stanley Trollope and I are great friends. We've been friends for a very long time. And on one occasion, we were exploring an area in Botswana. He's a pilot, and we'd flown into an area, and we were in the Savuti Game Reserve. And we saw a pack of hyenas pull down and consume a wildebeest, which was very exciting, maybe a bit gruesome, but a very exciting thing to see. But the amazing thing about it was that at the end of this attack by the hyenas, there was nothing of the wildebeest left except the horns. And I suppose after a few glasses of wine that evening, as we were reliving this incredible experience in the African bush, perhaps after a few more glasses of wine, we said, well, that would be a wonderful way of getting rid of a body if you were a murderer, because there'd be nothing left for the police to trace. There would be no case, because there'd be no evidence for them to follow.
Yes.
And we thought this was a great idea, and we went on talking about it for 20 years before we actually did anything about it.
Yes.
And then one day, as I was getting close to the end of my time at Anglo-American, or retiring from Anglo-American, I just sat down one afternoon and I visualized the scene of an ecologist and a game ranger spotting some vultures in the distance, and it turns out to be indeed that a hyena has is on a human body. And of course the mystery is not really about the hyenas or this interesting premise that we had, or we thought it was interesting, but really about why a murderer would want to go to all that trouble to make it so impossible to discover who this person actually was. Now, I must say, going back to your earlier comment, that there is a link between remote sensing and the novels, because one of the people who discovers the body is actually an ecologist who uses remote sensing extensively in his work. And he actually helps the police a little bit with solving the case, because he's able to get some satellite information which is of interest to them. And as we're writing these novels, and we're now, our fifth is about to be published in the States, and our sixth I'm busy working on at the moment with Stanley.
Do we have titles yet for those?
The new one will be called Death in the Family.
Death
will
in
be
the Family,
the,
yes.
The one that's going to come out in the US next year. But as we're working on those, there are a lot of things about this technology that we've talked about that are very important to the police. And for example, with satellite tracking technologies, actually not usually with satellites, but when you wander around with your cell phone, the police can actually trace where you've been on the basis of which towers the cell phone's connected to. I have to tell you, this makes it pretty hard for criminals, because as they're wandering around, the police can find out afterwards where they went. And it makes it pretty hard for mystery writers as well, because every time you come up with a really clever, sneaky little twist in your plot, you realize, the police would be able to use some modern remote sensing type technology to get around that. So there is a bit of this remote sensing that even comes into mysteries. I'm sorry I didn't answer your question.
I find this absolutely fascinating. I think it's just so awesome to be wearing these different hats, and here suddenly comes Death in the Family, Deadly Harvest, and all these incredible books containing such a degree of fiction and mystery and awe and wonder. And so my question to you, Michael, is, given the vast numbers of listeners we have and those who are downloading podcasts. How does one actually, how did someone like yourself, I mean, now you are very well known in this area, but I mean, to start with, it's a very, very competitive field. Do you just simply, does one blindly send a manuscript to a publisher? Do you need contacts? What must one do for one of our listeners to actually become or realize their dream, as it were, as a writer?
Yes, that's the question I didn't answer. So yes. I'm glad you're giving me a chance, a second bite of this cherry. David, things have changed dramatically over the years, and I'm not talking about over the 20 years or so since we started thinking about our book. I'm talking about even the last 5 years. Our first book was called A Carrion Death, and we sold originally perhaps 5% of the copies of the book that we sold were as ebooks. Of our latest book, Deadly Harvest, more than half of the sales have been ebooks.
Interesting.
So there's a huge change in the way people are reading books. And there is a connection between this and your question. Mm-hmm. We were enormously lucky. We wrote a book which appealed to a number of agents in New York. One of them took it on immediately, took it to HarperCollins and several other publishers. Two of them were interested. Two of them made bids on the book.
That's outstanding.
This is like winning a lottery. It's just so unusual, and we were so amazed by this. But we were very, very lucky. That's the truth of the matter. As you say, you can, in South Africa at least, you can write a book and send it blindly to a publisher. You can also, there are also people who will represent your books to publishers. And people do that a lot. I would advise people, if they're writing a book or they've written a book, to get some advice from other people. People often send me bits of manuscripts, and I'm happy to try and help, because we were so lucky that I'm only too delighted to try and feed back. You know, now I'm an instant expert because I've written a few books. But you can get a bit of a feel for what's right and wrong with a manuscript. But there are also courses, online courses, university courses that you can go to in creative writing. It's worth doing that. So this is just because we managed to, you know, reach our hand into the lottery hat and pull out the winning ticket. People shouldn't think that that's a likely way. The likely way is to build yourself up as a writer. But now, having said that, you don't need a traditional publisher these days. You can take advantage of that ebook, that electronic book market, automatically, directly yourself. And the way you can do that is you can write a book and you can yourself put it up on Amazon, which I'm sure your listeners know is a huge electronic marketing system. You can put it up there and you can set the price. Amazon will take a certain percentage of it, but most of the money of the sales of your book will come to you.
So the world is your oyster.
The world is your oyster. It's not the case with our books. We do not get most of the money from the books. Most of the money from our books goes into the bookstores and the publishers. And they, of course, are involved in marketing and things like that. I'm not saying it all goes in profit. But we get actually very low royalties on our books. Less than 10% on paperbacks. You can be getting 3/4 of the money for a book on Amazon. So there must be a catch. What's the catch? Why are we not doing this? It's so easy. The catch is, how do you get people to know about your books? And that is the big commitment. Writing a good book is hard work, tremendous commitment, and you'll be just thrilled when it's finished. And you yourself are a writer of excellent books, which I'm sure your listeners also know, and you will have shared the wonderful feeling of accomplishment when the book is finally finished.
Absolutely.
But getting sales out there, the marketing aspect.
Mm.
That's
key.
That's a huge commitment. So if you've written your novel, yes, you can get it published directly on Amazon, but then realize that you can't sit back and wait for people to buy it. There are 750,000 other books on Amazon that people can buy.
Mm.
You've got to get out there and market. And there are lots of online resources that you can use to help you do that.
Mm.
So there are two ways. Go for the traditional publisher. They will do a lot for your book, but you'll still have to do a lot yourself. Or you can put it up directly on Amazon, and then you'll have to do everything for the book yourself.
Mm.
And I wish everybody good luck, and I'm happy, as I say, to help people if they'd like to contact me.
You're listening to Professor David Block interviewing Professor Michael Sears, and I would like to give you the titles of some of his books, co-authored with by Stanley Trollope. You're on Amazon or anywhere else, you can Google the book Deadly Harvest, published by HarperCollins, New York, last year, 2013. Death of the Mantis, published by HarperCollins in New York, as well as in London, by Headline in 2011. The Second Death of Good Luck Tinubu by HarperCollins, 2009. And of course, this new book, which is mentioned, Death in the Family, if I recall correctly. Now, Michael, just to go back to that scene of the hyenas and the wildebeest, I think this is quite extraordinary that one should come up, you know, with this great degree of mystery. You know, suddenly the wildebeest, the hyenas, and the wildebeest is essentially devoured and gone. May I ask you this question? Because I know you as a professor, of course, of applied mathematics. I know you as a professor in computer science. I know you also as an extremely creative writer. When you see a scene like that, the hyenas and the wildebeest, do you actually look at the world mathematically, analytically, or do you see it more in a sense of mystery and art and intrigue? Because often mathematicians don't always wear the other set of spectacles. Was it not Marcel Proust who said, "The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeing new landscapes, but in having new eyes"? And of course, that's where you and Stanley Trollope really come to the fore, is that you're not seeking new landscapes, but you are having a remarkable set of new eyes. How do you actually perceive a scene like that and the world in general? For example, a rushing waterfall.
Oh, what a fascinating question. Yes, I think that you're right. You don't see these things analytically. I gave the example of the ecologist in the book. He ended up playing quite a small role in the book because our hero turns out to be the policeman at the Botswana CID, whose nickname is Kubu, which means hippo in Setswana. And I think he also sees things very differently. But I think to be a writer, you need to look at things differently. You need to listen to people. You need to watch scenes and have an emotional impact that comes from them. The wildebeest and the hyenas was an emotional experience. It wasn't an analytic experience at all. The analysis, as I said, came afterwards, and only probably with the help of a small amount of alcohol. So, you know, that certainly wasn't the feeling at the time. And I think that generally speaking, when I look at something, you mentioned a waterfall, I don't think, I could describe that by picking out that little bit of yellow on the side as the water's going over that mossy rock. I could talk about the mist coming off it. It's an impact that it has on me as a person.
Mm.
And those other things are when your subconscious sort of shoves information across to your, or something, I don't know what to call it, information, shoves it across to your conscious mind, and then you start working with the words, and you start using such skills as you have with words in order to try and communicate this emotional experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a difficult thing to do, and only the most brilliant writers are really successful at it.
Of course, what's very interesting is that, you know, given the handful of real jewels in terms of writing who are just brilliant in, you know, transmuting their emotions to their vast number of readers, you are totally unique in this aspect, is that, you know, one can ask you about, you know, any area of topology, and, you know, you're very most comfortable with it. And yet, many topologists would not really be emotionally inclined in terms of invoking the subconscious. And I think that this is really what sets Professor Michael Sears absolutely unique, is that he's got this extremely deep understanding about nature and about how our planet, the pale blue dot, actually functions. But he's also got this sense of mystery, of awe, and of wonder. I would like to tell our listeners that Michael taught me applied mathematics many years ago, and he instilled in me one word: passion. You know, I've always said on radio and on television, passion is never taught, it is caught. And Michael, it is very interesting that you have entered this world of the writing of books and of mysteries and so on. Could you tell us a little bit more about your Inspector Cooper?
David, you're much too kind about me, but I'd certainly, of course, love to tell you about Inspector Kubu. We have a very soft spot for him. He's a very large man in the Botswana CID. He loves his food and doesn't turn down a glass of wine on occasion. People ask us, where did he come from?
Yes.
And is he based on something?
Yes.
And in fact, he's not based on anybody as far as we know, except to the extent that all things are based on other things. So, you know, there will be connections with other books and other people. But he actually went to investigate this crime. The ecologist let him know that there was a murder, and of course the police had to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
So he climbed into his Land Rover, which was a bit of a clamber because he's a very large man, as I said.
Yes.
And he would say well built, but mm-hmm. we would say overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his sandwiches with him and his cold drinks, and he put a cassette of music in his cassette player, and he took off into the desert, and he thought about how he'd become a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which he'd learnt from a bushman school friend
mm-hmm.
about seeing things more deeply, exactly mm-hmm. the sort of things that you've been talking
mm-hmm.
about. And I think it's a skill or something of a calling for a detective.
Mm.
And by the time he reached the murder scene, he'd completely taken over the book. We had intended that the ecologist was going to be the main character in the story, but Kubu shoved him aside and took over, and Kubu became the hero of the book, eventually solved the crime. His family plays a role in our books, and we reflect Botswana, and we try and reflect issues that are important in Southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And because our books are set not in South Africa but in Botswana, we are able perhaps sometimes to bring in things that are a little off the beaten track from a South African perspective.
Mm.
Like Death of the Mantis is around the plight of the Bushman people of the Kalahari.
Mm.
And we have the background of Zimbabwe, blood diamonds,
mm-hmm.
The power of the witch doctors. These are the things that make the backstories against which we hope we set an entertaining and enjoyable mystery.
Michael, thank you so much for joining me in studio today. You've been listening to Professor Michael Sears, who's one of certainly the most esteemed professors in our country and, in fact, abroad. And I say that absolutely from the heart. He's also the author, together with Stanley Trollope, of Deadly Harvest, Death of the Mantis, and several other books. And we look forward, greatly forward, to welcoming both him and Stanley Trollope in this very studio in a few months' time. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, we play out with Enya.